It's Morning Edition on 90.1 WABE. Great to have you along. I'm Dennis O'Hare. The presidential campaigns at least kept nodding in Georgia's direction in the last few weeks. Meanwhile, there are some homegrown battles being fought. Time again for a little political breakfast with Theron Johnson, Democratic strategist who was National Southern Regional Director for President Obama's 2012 campaign, and Brian Robinson, former Deputy Chief of Staff to Republican Governor Nathan Deal. Great to have both of you back. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Newt Gingrich was in Georgia. He was at Kennesaw State University, back in his old stomping grounds. Brian, there are two ways you can look at his appearance, depending, of course, on which candidate you favor. He's either a sign that the Trump campaign is worried and needs to shore up Georgia, or he's a sign that Newt Gingrich being a vote turnout machine is just the key to victory that they need.
The conventional wisdom is that this is still Trump's state to lose. And I believe that. I think that Hillary's pathway to victory, however much ballyhooed by Democrats, is still very, very difficult to achieve. Trump should win Georgia's 16 electoral votes. But the polls are tight, and both campaigns are taking notice. Both are putting some resources here.
Democrats bought some ad time.
They bought some ad time, which suggests that maybe they have a glimmer of hope, but it's not a real significant. It looks more like a head fake at this juncture. It's not enough to really move the needle in any way. But the Trump campaign has given us some attention. We had a high-profile visit from Newt Gingrich 2 weeks ago. We had a high-profile two-day visit from VP candidate Mike Pence, whose operation is being run by a Georgian, Nick Ayers. So a lot of good Georgia connections at play here. And Georgia is going to be that southern state. That's the next purple state. I mean, I think Republicans acknowledge that. Now is the moment where we've got to get serious. We've got to start looking at our turnout machine. We cannot assume victory every single election the way we have the last 8 years, 10 years. And you're beginning to see a little bit that play out in the strategy with people showing up here and putting resources here.
I think if you look at the national polls, particularly this past Sunday, where on Meet the Press, it showed that Hillary Clinton was actually winning Georgia. Now, it was only by a percentage.
Yeah, and there are other polls showing her a point or two behind, but statistical ties all around.
Right, and here's the concern for the Trump campaign. If you are running for president and Georgia has been a Republican stronghold since 1996 when Bill Clinton won the state when he was running for president, and you are statistically in a dead heat or tied with your opponent, it's got to be grave concerns, not only for them in Georgia, but all across the nation. Dennis, what I think is happening is that there's two groups that really Donald Trump has been struggling with. One, there's a huge number of disaffected Republicans in Georgia. I would say that my good friend Brian Robinson is probably one of those disaffected Republicans.
But Trump won the primary here going away.
Correct. But he won the primary. And as we know, is that primary voters are a little different than general election voters. But listen, what Donald Trump did in Georgia is that he excited the Donald Trump base. You know, these are folks who were upset with the mainstream sort of insider Republicans, and they basically went to the person that they were attracted to. But back to my point about disaffected Republicans, like my good friend Brian Robinson, these are folks who are Republicans because of the values. These are traditional voters who vote for Republicans because they want less government, they want less waste, they want less debt, they want someone who at least will appear to be open to reaching out to different demographic groups. And they're particularly concerned about education. I think Brian will say I pretty much describe a Georgia Republican pretty well. But what's happening is that you got the complete opposite in Donald Trump. This is a gentleman who has disrespected every single constituency group there is to be insulted. He's been reprimanded by members of his own party in the Republican Party. And quite frankly, now at a time where he's sort of taking a very unprecedented step to basically say that he's open to paid leave and dealing with family medical leave and paid leave. This is something that the Republicans have never done. The second group of people that I think are taking a second and third and fourth look at not only Hillary Clinton, but also the independent candidate, are women. I think that Donald Trump is doing an extremely terrible job of making women feel comfortable that he would be the right person at the right time to be president of the United States. Now, what Democrats have got to do is that we've got to continue to try to register as many people as we can before this deadline. But more importantly, we've got to make sure that our base is fired up, and we got to make sure that we go to those two groups, the disaffected Republicans and women voters in Georgia, and try to get them to vote for Hillary.
Theron, how do Democrats then address a pretty clear enthusiasm gap for Hillary Clinton, not only here in Georgia, but around the country? There was tremendous turnout for President Obama in 2008 and 2012 here.
Well, what made me so proud is the day before yesterday, I saw my former boss, President Barack Obama, who, by the way, if you really look at a Washington Post report and you really get down into the tabs and take a deeper dive, it suggested that he actually has a 57-58% approval rating right now. But I was so happy to see him in Pennsylvania, in a battleground state, really sort of being to Hillary Clinton what Bill Clinton was for him, and that is sort of explaining what's at stake. I think that you're going to see President Obama, First Lady Michelle Obama, who's more popular than him in the African-American community, hit the ground running in every single battleground state. And I think African-Americans and Latinos are going to hear a crystal clear message from the Obamas of why it's more important for them to vote for Hillary Clinton, someone who would continue his support of helping their community versus Donald Trump.
But Brian, just as the Democrats are going to need a ground game here, the Republicans will too. And the Trump campaign has been really slow to set that up.
Any Republican operative will tell you that the Trump campaign has not had a traditional campaign mechanism like what you would have seen in the Romney campaign or the McCain campaign or the Bush campaigns. It is a one-man show on Twitter with rallies. The campaign staff does advance for rally. That's what they do. I've always wondered how much that ground game really matters. I'm a communications guy, so I'm a little biased. I really believe that messages are what sell voters.
Especially in an era when you are able to reach more people through more media, the ground game may matter less. But come Election Day, they still have to get out and go to the polls.
Yeah, I don't even really know what the ground game is. I mean, no one's ever came and picked me up in a car to go to the polls, and I've never missed an election. I don't really know what it does. But wait, I think what Theron got to, talking about the enthusiasm gap with Hillary Clinton, you're definitely seeing that in Georgia. The problem with these media polls showing a dead heat in Georgia or sometimes showing her with a slight lead is that if you polled every eligible voter in Georgia, yeah, the Democrats would do great. But we know historically they don't show up. We keep hearing about this phantom Democrat vote out there. They don't go to the polls. If you just poll them randomly, sure, yeah, they're for Hillary. But they're not voters, really. They don't show up. And that's the problem they have. And it's the problem that she's going to have nationally, because even Democrats aren't enthusiastic about Hillary Clinton. The only thing that's overheated about Hillary Clinton's campaign is 80-degree weather.
But isn't the motivation factor also a problem for many Republicans beyond the Trump base?
It is something that we have to look at, and particularly when you consider the down-ballot Republicans, which is where my focus is. I believe Georgia Republicans have a moral duty to show up on November the 8th or for early voting to vote for Johnny Isakson and our Republican legislature. It is so critical to the future of this state. Look at the string of Republican successes we've had in Georgia in the last 2 weeks. New tire company with more than 1,000 jobs in LaGrange. High-paying, high-tech jobs with Honeywell and NCR coming to Atlanta.
The timing of those announcements couldn't have been coincidence, could it?
We would never be that cynical, Dennis. This is about giving good jobs to Georgians. That's what this is about. Republican leadership in Georgia is working, and Republican voters, no matter what they think about Donald Trump, need to show up. Please go to the polls.
Two things I want to respond to. One, my good friend's lack of knowledge of really what a ground game actually looks like. And then two, this whole enthusiasm gap. The problem with Donald Trump is this. He starts off with 206 electoral votes. Those are the amount of votes that Mitt Romney got in 2012. If Republicans like Brian are saying that they don't know what a ground game is, or that he doesn't necessarily have a ground game, which he doesn't, which Ted Cruz had and which Marco Rubio had a little bit of, it really presents a problem at a time where we're about 7 to 8 days from early voting in most states. And actually, I think today is the first day, or if it's the second day, you can actually pull an absentee ballot in Georgia. So if Republicans are totally going against what has worked for them in the past in midterm elections, which is putting together a ground game of support, grassroots support, to come out and oppose Obamacare or to oppose whatever, then I feel real good about our chances in November. The second thing about the enthusiasm gap is that Trump's enthusiasm gap is worse than Hillary Clinton's, because the problem is, at a time where he has a Republican base of support in states like Georgia and South Carolina and a little bit of North Carolina, these disaffected Republicans who didn't want him to be their nominee in the first place are not enthusiastic about them. What they're enthusiastic about is that they like to say that Hillary Clinton is untrustworthy. Well, I would tell you, they also know that Donald Trump is unstable and he's unfit to be president. And so I think that's what you're going to see on Election Day, where you're going to see a lack of turnout on the Republican side.
If you want to make sure that those Republicans who aren't that enthusiastic about Trump do show up, the way that you should do it is to go out and call them members of a basket of deplorables. That is a great way to get the other side riled up and ready to go vote. So I want to thank her personally for lying about her health. I wanted to thank her for lying about having pneumonia, for lying about saying that she was just overheated, and for insulting 50% of the American electorate.
First of all, she did not lie about having pneumonia. Now, should she have reported it earlier? Yes. You and I worked on campaigns. I think that situation could have been handled maybe a little differently. Secondly, she did not lie about her medical records. Lastly, is that we know that Donald Trump has told way more lies and has basically even, you know, misstated a lot of his positions throughout his campaign way more than Hillary Clinton has. So I don't think we want to get into that argument.
And if any of that's true, why in the world is Hillary Clinton not pulling away in the polls? Why, in fact, is Donald Trump closing the gap? That is a question that Theron can't answer.
No, I'll answer it really quickly. Is I'm not going to criticize national polls because I do think that they have some relevance. However, what I'm paying close attention to, Brian, and what I'm sure people in the Trump campaign is paying very close attention to, is that when I see Hillary Clinton's up by 4 to 6% in states like Florida, I see that she's holding a steady lead in Ohio. I even see that she's actually got a growing lead in Pennsylvania. And even in North Carolina, which Donald Trump does have a small lead, to me, it's all about 270, which is the amount of electoral votes that she's got to get. That gives me a great deal of calm.
Isn't there a topsy-turvy kind of feel to this election, though, because we do see Hillary Clinton's lead shrinking in states where a few weeks ago she was expected to win, New Hampshire, even though it's a small state, electorally speaking, and yet she's, according to the polls, pulling even in places like Georgia. So we're seeing candidates do well in states where they weren't expected to do well, and poorly in states where they should be doing well. It's very odd this year.
You actually said something that's so important, Dennis. What I think is going on in this country is that people actually identify themselves less with a particular party, and it's more about the ideas and the policy stances that the candidates have. Let's give Donald Trump some credit. I've been fair to this guy. I know it drives Brian crazy that I continue to try to, you know, wrap him around his neck. But let's be fair. Listen, Donald Trump has totally revolutionized the way you run for president of the United States. I've never seen a guy who comes out and basically changes positions on immigration, says some of the most deplorable things about women and different ethnic groups, and gets away with it. So what it's showing is that the American people are looking for a sort of quote-unquote outsider perspective and someone who is going to speak the truth. The challenge is that we, as Brian has stated many, many times before, we have two of the most unpopular people to run for president of the United States. But the difference maker for Hillary Clinton, I think, is going to be this. If you look at these polls in New Hampshire and other places where she's expected to win, and you look at the amount of time that they've had to build a ground game there and being able to reach out to independents. I mean, one number that stuck out to me is that Mitt Romney did extremely well with independent college-educated women in 2012. I think he got roughly pretty close to 40% of those women. Polling is showing now that Donald Trump is in the single digits with those particular women. I think, and I've said it time and time again, in these key battleground states that we've all talked about, educated, white, moderate women are going to be the difference makers, and I think ultimately they'll go towards Hillary Clinton.
Brian, real quickly, Trump's proposal for family leave and other initiatives directed at women and actually introduced by his daughter Ivanka, effective in getting those voters that Theron just talked about, or too little too late?
I think Republicans have to begin to offer solutions for families in crisis, for families that are facing tremendous challenges between paying the bills and being there as good parents. This issue has come to life for me in a way that it never had before, because my daughter is going to be born next month, my first. And
we hope it goes well.
Well, thank you. Me too.
And your wife looks great. I saw her the other night. She looks wonderful.
Yeah, man.
I don't know how she puts up with you.
Sometimes people make bad choices, and she did. And I am seeing firsthand just how challenging it's going to be with two working parents to raise a child and be there the way that we want to be there. It's a standard that has been adopted throughout the industrialized world. We are a lagging indicator on this. I am concerned about employer mandates. I think that the unintended consequence is if you tell employers they've got to pay for a year of leave like they have in certain parts of Europe or even 2 years in some places, you're disincentivizing hiring women. And I think that is a dangerous precedent. I worry about that. And we've got to figure out a pathway where it doesn't become economically unfeasible to hire women of childbearing age.
The big difference between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders during the primary was this whole family medical leave issue. Hillary Clinton has had up on her website for a very long time that she supports 12 weeks, which is different from Donald Trump. Donald Trump is proposing 6 weeks. The other difference between her plan that she, again, has had public for a very long time is that also her plan covers men and not just women. Donald Trump's plan currently only covers women. But is this another play for Donald Trump to show that he's not as divisive as we think he is and trying to appeal to white, suburban, independent, college-educated women? Absolutely. But the challenge is that what's so revolutionary here is that this is something that's never really been done by the Republican Party. So at a time where I think he's appealing to those folks, I think it's going to hurt him a little bit with his base, and I think folks are going to, you know, not want to support it because it's not been a Republican issue over the decades.
I do think the six-week compromise is reasonable. That's not a length of time that's going to disincentivize hiring of women, which was one of my major concerns. You know, we all believe in equal pay for equal work in the workforce. You know, part of that is making sure that women have access to the workforce, making sure that when they leave for childbirth, they can come back, stay where they have been professionally, and continue to advance forward.
But the problem is that, and listen, I will compliment Donald Trump once again, this is the second time, that he actually put forth a concrete plan. This was so, again, striking. This is something that he's never done. But also, you really got to look at how he's going to pay for it. When Donald Trump was asked the question, how you're going to pay for this, he wants to use unemployment insurance, whereas Hillary Clinton is saying that she'll pay for it by giving a person two-thirds of their income. Again, I encourage our listeners to really look at the two plans because I think Hillary Clinton's ultimately is better for our country.
Let's turn to some battles within the state. The Opportunity School District, Governor Deal's plan to take over some failing schools, is on the ballot in November. It's starting to generate a little heat. We've got some organized opposition from some local school boards. Brian, I'll start with you since he is your former boss. He enlisted some Democratic support to push for it. Do people really understand how this works, though, or do both sides have to do a little bit of, if you will, education to get voters to understand it?
I think the ballot question itself is going to be very helpful to this effort because—
Some interesting wording there.
It definitely makes you feel like a bad person if you vote no, which is what it should do, because we are talking about children trapped in chronically failing schools. We know they're not getting job skills. We know they're not getting soft skills. We know that most of them are going to drop out. We know that most of them are not going to be able to support themselves or their families, and that many will end up in prison. And we have got to do a better job. And this is a temporary intrusion into these schools by the state, just 5 years in and out. When the opponents talk about this, they talk about teachers. They talk about adults. They talk about school boards. They never talk about children. It is children's lives at stake. We need to restore the American dream, and it doesn't matter what neighborhood you're born into. You should have the right to equal access to opportunity of education.
Theron, does this put Democrats who have traditionally opposed this kind of thing in a box when you look at how these schools are doing? There's a limited number that could be taken over to begin with, and they would be theoretically the ones that are performing the worst among a whole group of poorly performing schools.
The problem with the Opportunity School District proposal really started about a year ago, is when the media basically promoted this narrative of all of these quote-unquote failing schools in our state. They did not have a metrics to show how these schools were not only failing, but also the schools that were succeeding. So that automatically put a very, very bad taste in a lot of elected officials' mouth, but also parents are very concerned. The second thing with OSD is this. If you really look at the question, people cannot really believe the hype. I encourage people as you continue to look at this issue to really, truly look at the question. Lastly, is that Republicans during the Bush years, their whole thing was local control, let's let our local teachers, let's let our school boards decide the future of our kids. If OSD was to pass, it takes away local control totally from the parents, totally from the teachers and the school board members. What it's doing is it's setting up a more bureaucratic system for a governor to basically have an opportunity to appoint whoever he wants to basically be this person to, quote unquote, give our schools more opportunity. The last issue with this whole OSD is this. It's not worked in other places. If you look at places like Tennessee, if you look at places like Louisiana and New Orleans, I think it was Memphis, the Opportunity School District proposal, which is really sort of more of going to a charter system, does not work. I think what the governor and others should do is really take the serious pushback that they're getting from parents, the serious pushback that they're going to get from elected officials to say, listen, this was not clearly explained to us. You put together a ballot question that most voters don't understand. But more importantly, it is only going to do harm to public schools. I'm a public school student. I turn out okay. I didn't end up in prison, Brian. I'm actually a productive citizen. You back with this Donald Trump rhetoric of what do I have to lose? I tell you what, I have a lot to lose. I support public school teachers. I support the public school education system. And I think that the governor is receiving others. Republican leadership are going to continue to receive a lot of pushback because we do not need a more bureaucratic system to teach our kids how to learn. What we need to do is it's bureaucratic. You know that. But if you look at the question and if you look at the bill that was actually presented, it not only gives the governor control to, quote unquote, take over these schools, but it creates a more bureaucratic system of learning, which we don't need in our school systems. What we need to do is give our teachers who want to teach and deserve to be there with tenure or without tenure, give them more power to teach our schools, give our local school boards the power to continue to work with the parents and the teacher to make sure that they're receiving a good education. OSD does not do that.
What a dramatic defense of a failing status quo that has left generation after generation of Georgians in a cycle of poverty. We know that the system isn't working. We know that there are, every once in a while, that star student who comes through those circumstances and overcomes because they've got great parents who are involved and they're able to get into college, take that next step up the ladder. But that is the exception, not the rule. And we know it. Go to neighborhoods in Atlanta or Augusta, Savannah, Macon, Columbus. You know a failing school when you see it.
But, Brian, we've seen cuts to the state's portion of but gets funneled to local schools for years now. They were billed as austerity cuts under Governor Perdue, and the argument could be made, okay, you're just throwing good money after bad if these schools are systemically failing. On the other hand, you could say, look, how can you succeed if you don't have the resources to do it? You can argue either way.
I think that's malarkey, and here's why.
You got that from Joe Biden, didn't you?
Uncle Joe.
I do have a little Irish in me, too. Schools all over this country took cuts during the Great Recession. Every government program in the country except for entitlements took a cut during the recession. That's just how it was. We spend $8,000 to $9,000 per student in Georgia. How much is enough? Is it going to be $15,000, $16,000, $17,000? Is that what we got to do? We're spending a lot of money and in too many cases getting bad outcomes. It is not a good investment for taxpayers. We are putting plenty of money into it. And I will say that as the budget picture in Georgia has improved in the last 2 to 3 years, and I was still in the governor's office for some of this as it was beginning to come back, Governor Deal disproportionately added money to education. We've almost closed that austerity cut, the so-called austerity cut. It's not really a cut. Yeah, it's to use Theron's phrase, bureaucratic budget making that causes the quote unquote cuts. There's plenty of money going into the school systems. The question is, how much is ever going to be enough? We've got to fix the fundamentals, and that's what OSD might do.
But I'm so glad you brought up that point, Dennis, because we've seen in Georgia by Republican leadership, particularly in the governor's office, time after time, cuts to education. But let's get back to the root of this problem. The effect that a outside entity in this outside plan of an opportunity school district, when you label children in a school as a failing school, it has a lifetime effect on their ability to go out, not only to learn in that school, but to actually be a productive citizen by having a job. My point is this. Do we need to do something about education, particularly public education in Georgia? Absolutely, yes. But coming in with a takeover program, taking away the ability for teachers, parents, and school board members to teach our kids, and to put forth a negative narrative of basically identifying all of these schools as failing schools without actually complimenting the schools, particularly in the metro area, as schools who are actually successful schools, is something that the Republicans and the media crafted. The pushback that they're receiving is because they have not been able to effectively explain what are you going to get differently with that plan versus what we're getting now. So I'm never the person to say that we don't need to do something. I just think the whole way that the Opportunity School District's plan was rolled out was something that was very negative, and I think that most of people are bucking against it, and I don't think they're going to support it ultimately.
Let's just give them all trophies. That way everybody feel good about themselves, and life will be swell. They'll just be winners in life because, hey, look, they've got a trophy. They must be winners. They must be educated.
But Brian, here's the problem. I agree with you. The equalizer between me as an African-American person, and I don't know if you attended public schools or not. I did all 12 years. The equalizer for me were two things. One, I had parents. I had particularly a mom who basically made sure that I went to school every day, that I did my homework, and I respected my teachers, and I basically made sure that I made good grades so I can go on and have a productive life. But the second thing was is that at that time, under Democratic leadership in Georgia, we had governors who would also work with the local school boards to make sure that we had enough funding to grow and have different programs. This whole thing about just saying we want to do away with the teachers and want to change the system because that leads to particularly minority students in poverty, and they're going to go to prison, they're going to rob us, and they're going to kick down our doors in our suburban neighborhoods. That's not the quick fix to the problem. It's a systemic problem where we got to basically give teachers more incentives, teachers more support to basically be able to teach the kids nowadays that are much different than when you and I went to school. So I think, again, when Republicans want to talk about improving education in Georgia, it's got to be a confluence between power and finesse, not just power with your money and say we're just going to take it over, but it's also got to be a huge level of understanding of the systematic problems that we face in our school system.
I'm so glad you brought up my background. My parents scrimped and saved to send me to private school because our home public school district was a failing school. I would not have been able to go to college if I had gone to my local public school, even with the support of two loving, smart, educated parents. It was that bad. No good products came out of that school. It had a 7% graduation rate. That's not a made-up number. That's what it was when I was growing up there. But you know what? My parents weren't rich, but they had enough to prioritize our education and get me out and give me and my brothers a chance. I had that. Black and brown children should have that too.
But the difference is, Brian, what about the people like me who had a single mom who had to work 3 to 4 jobs, who could not save because every single penny that she made had to go between raising my brother and my sisters? Those kids are a greater number than people like you that are in our public school systems. That's my point I'm making exactly. You cannot just come in and basically say that because of the school system, the way it currently exists, is the reason why we have kids going to prison and the reason we have poverty. I'm the rare exception of that. I'm the person that actually made it out of the public school system. So your whole tone is the public systems, school systems are bad, they don't work, and my parents were able to save up money to send me to a private school. Well, that's great, Brian. You had an opportunity. But the majority of students who attend public schools, particularly the ones who are on free and fixed lunch, don't have that alternative. The only alternative they have is the public school system.
My point exactly. They're trapped.
No, they're not. But where are they going to go?
Exactly. The Opportunity School District.
Until you show me the progress that this plan has made in places like Tennessee and New Orleans and Louisiana, then I'll be more open to it.
Let's give the benefit of the doubt and some trust to a Republican governor whose reforms have led to 19% reduction in African Americans going into our state prisons. This is a governor whose heart is in the right place, whose mind and policies meld with it very well and very successfully for the people of the state.
Different subject, and this is the intersection of local forces and national politics. There's a new American Bar Association president who is from Atlanta, Linda Klein. She was with us here on Morning Edition yesterday, And in her first few days as American Bar Association president, she has written a letter to Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, and Harry Reid, the Democratic leader in the Senate, saying at least vote on about 20 of these backed up federal judicial nominations, the non-controversial ones, if you will. Not Merrick Garland for the Supreme Court, but some of these just district court judges in places where they're badly needed. And David Perdue is at the center of a judicial fight here for a federal district court seat. Mm-hmm. Does she bring any weight at all to this?
I think she not only brings weight to the conversation, I actually think it's a conversation that needs to be at the forefront as we look at what's going on nationally and locally. One of the things that I think that President Obama reminded us of the other day is that he's got 4 months to go. One of the things that I hope that he and his administration will do is to make sure that we have a lot of these vacant seats, a lot of these seats beyond Garland's seat that can actually be filled, to work with states and local jurisdictions to get these positions filled. Because the challenge is that we have so many judges who actually have a huge amount of overload and have cases that they can't even get to all of. And then the backlog is real. So this is something that I think that was very interesting for her to bring to the forefront. And I think you're going to see the presidential candidates start to talk more and more about it as we get to the debates.
And Brian, Governor Deal on the state level is making the argument, look, our judges are overburdened. We need to have more judges. So does that then translate? Does it give Democrats in the Senate in Washington some ammunition?
In Georgia, we have a system that is working. And in D.C., we have a system that is not working. And it is a bipartisan problem. You know, Democrats seem to have a lot of values and morals about approving judges and how that's what you're supposed to do under the Constitution whenever Republicans control the Senate. They're there's a bipartisan.
Let's just stipulate that each side has held up the presidential nominations of the other party for years now.
And then lie about it and act like they were never they never did it. It is disingenuous. It is a broken system. It is hurting the judiciary and its ability to do its job. Now, there's not a short-term fix, such as approving a slew of district court judges named by a liberal Democrat president. There's got to be a long-term solution so that both sides know there's going to be equity, that when their side wins the White House, they're going to get the discretion to appoint judges unless there's a major glaring flaw with that candidate. But until both sides disarm, no one's going
to
disarm.
But this is an opportunity for Republicans and Democrats to work together. I mean, I wouldn't go so far as to say that, you know, that President Obama is this big old liberal president that Brian likes to describe. I mean, he's a very popular president at 58%. But David Perdue, Johnny Isaacson, President Obama, Governor Deal can all work together to do what's right around these judicial vacancies that we have. And so, again, at a time where we're looking for bipartisanship in Washington, Brian, I see it in every poll that we read. One of the things that the American people want is for Republicans and Democrats to work together in Washington and ultimately let that trickle down to the state of Georgia. That is a missed opportunity here, I think.
Brian, do you think that Linda Klein's initiative, though, will get any sort of results in a Washington that is just trying to get to the finish line at the end of December?
No, because the people who elect U.S. senators in primaries on both sides, Democrat and Republican, don't want bipartisanship. They don't want compromise. They want hardcore stands on purity, whether it be liberal purity or conservative purity. And any compromise, any concession to the other side is surrender, and it is waving the white flag. And until we get past that mindset, we're not going to see progress. As long as people who are in the Just Say No caucus in Democrat and Republican politics rule primaries, this is going to be the broken system we have. Americans can't say they want bipartisanship and compromise and getting things done in polling and then not elect the people who do that when they do it.
I disagree. I think that Mrs. Klein's comments and basically bringing this issue to the forefront is going to have an effect in the next 54 days in this election. I guarantee you that it's going to come up in the debates. I guarantee you that President Obama is going to talk about it, because if he's smart, he's got to push this. I mean, he expended a lot of political capital of getting Garland, hopefully, you know, to get even just an up and down vote. I think that this is, again, the one opportunity where one of our presidential candidates, whether it's Trump or Clinton, if they were to embrace and support what she's trying to do, I think this ultimately would play very well for them in their outcome of the presidential election.
Theron Johnson is a Democratic strategist who is National Southern Regional Director for President Obama's 2012 campaign. Brian Robinson, former Deputy Chief of Staff to Republican Governor Nathan Deal. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Same here,
good
to be here.
See you again soon.